And now, a shaggy dog story. Scientists have located the genes that make a poodle's hair curly and a collie's hair long and straight. But the research is not so much about hair as it is about how genes cause disease. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports that the hair of the dog has a tale to tell.
Before we get to the science, let's get the skinny on dog hair from a hands-on expert, dog groomer Patty Dunn, who works at Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital in Maryland.
This is the kennel. This is where they board.
She gamely tries to describe the kinds of dog hair she has to work with.
It's an old English sheepdog on the left. He's just had his hair cut. They definitely have really long hair coats.
Okay, so dogs wanted no part of this. We retreated, and I pressed on in my investigation of canine coiffure.
A poodle would definitely give you more options as far as a haircut goes than a border collie. A poodle kind of has like an afro that you can fluff up and do anything you want to, whereas a border collie lies flat, so you have fewer options.
And that difference is exactly why geneticist Elaine Ostrander studied dog hair.
So if you think about a dog's coat, it can be long, it can be short, it can be curly, it can be wavy, it can be straight, it can be wiry, it can be soft.
Ostrander, who works at the National Human Genome Research Institute, wanted to know how genes create all this variety. So she studied about 1,000 dogs from about 90 different breeds. She searched dog DNA the way a chef might compare recipes for a souffle. What changed ingredient makes one different from the next? What mutation gives an Airedale his curls and a golden retriever her tresses? What she discovered, and published in the journal Science, was that a mere 3 genes control all the different kinds of dog hair.
This particular study has demonstrated to us how you can take a seemingly really complex trait. You can go to the dog park, and every breed of dog looks different than every other breed, it seems. And yet, you know, when we get down to the molecular biology, we really find that it's combinations of 3 different genes that accounts for all that variation. And that's incredible. I mean, 20 years ago, I never would have predicted that.
Now, this actually has value in studying disease. Human and dog cancers are very similar. So the fact that only 3 genes can create so much variation in hair might provide clues to how genes cause so many cancers in dogs and humans.
Whether or not the exact same gene is mutated in humans doesn't really matter. It's telling us the pathways that are involved, the kinds of genes that are involved, and the kinds of changes in those genes that lead to those diseases.
Ostrander admits she had help with her research from one particular border collie.
Tess. It was short for Contessa because she thought she was really something. I got her when she was 9 weeks old. And for the first 10 years of my career, she came to work with me most days.
Tess has since died, but is remembered as spending her time in the lab herding graduate students. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Scientists in Oregon have developed a technique that could be used to prevent certain genetic diseases. They've demonstrated it in monkeys and are now eager to try it in people. But the technique raises ethical questions because, as NPR's Richard Harris reports, it makes a permanent genetic change not just in an individual, but in all generations that follow.
You need to know just a bit of biology before you can understand what these guys are doing. Most of our genes are in our chromosomes, which are in the cell's inner sanctum, the nucleus. But 37 human genes are outside the nucleus. They are contained in tiny bodies called mitochondria, which float around in our cells. Mitochondria are the mini power plants for our cells, and mutations in the genes inside mitochondria can cause disease. Shukrat Mitalipov and his colleagues at Oregon Health and Science University are trying to figure out how to treat this class of rare genetic diseases. They've been working with eggs of rhesus monkeys. If you fix a genetic problem in an egg, you'll fix it in all the cells the egg grows into, the whole animal.
So basically, we construct this experimental egg, which will contain, you know, nuclear genes from one female, but mitochondria genes from another female.
In short, they can remove the nucleus from an egg that has defective mitochondrial genes and put it into an egg that has healthy mitochondria. so the mother's chromosomes end up in an egg that has healthy mitochondria, albeit from a different female. And the technique worked quite well in monkeys, according to a study Nature magazine has published online. The researchers made this transfer with 15 eggs, fertilized them, and ended up with 4 baby monkeys.
So what we showed is these manipulated eggs behave like a normal eggs, and most importantly, they resulted in births of healthy offspring.
The monkeys are only a few months old so far. It will take 4 or 5 years before the scientists know whether they are able to reproduce successfully, and it could take even longer to notice any long-term health effects. Mita Lipov says he doesn't want to wait that long. He wants to try the technique in people. To do that, he would need to convince the Food and Drug Administration that the technique is safe, and he will also have to deal with a key ethical issue. Art Kaplan at the University of Pennsylvania says the issue is that modifying eggs means that the change doesn't merely affect one individual.
It goes on forever because it's passed on from generation to generation.
This kind of manipulation is called germline therapy, and it's been considered taboo. For one thing, if there are health risks, they will affect multiple generations. For another, it could open the door to genetically engineering a lineage of people with supposedly superior qualities. This is called eugenics, and many people find that repugnant. So Kaplan says the proposal to try this technique in humans deserves special attention.
It does breach the principle, no germline engineering. It breaches a promise that many geneticists have made that whatever else, they're not going down that road. I always thought that promise would be difficult to keep. This particular experiment shows why.
Kaplan argues the egg manipulation in this case isn't seeking to make an improved person, just a healthy one, and he's okay with that. But George Annis at Boston University is uneasy, both for ethical reasons and for practical ones.
I don't think anything should necessarily be totally off the table, although this would be pretty extreme. This would certainly be at that end that I would probably have a presumption it shouldn't be done, and the burden of proof would be on the people who are proposing it to show that it's safe and that it's not going to create problems, not just for the children, but for the children's children.
And he says it will take a lot more than just 4 apparently healthy baby monkeys to make that case. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Archaeologists are often thought of in that Indiana Jones kind of way, you know, flying off to remote ruins in search of mysterious treasures. But a lot of new archaeology isn't about objects at all. It's about ancient environments. One thing scientists are finding, that even hunter-gatherers changed their environment. NPR's Christopher Joyce has his story about how they altered North America's coastlines.
Torben Rick has the kind of earnest enthusiasm for archaeology that you have to have if you're going to spend months digging in the dirt for fish bones and scallop shells, and he is duly proud when he finds something interesting.
What I've got out here are a couple. I'll open the bag. These are red abalones.
They're big pinkish shells that Rick found on San Miguel Island in California and now keeps at his sunny laboratory at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. For Rick, these palm-sized shells are 6,500-year-old clues to help answer a big question.
How did people impact the environments in which they lived? And specifically, how did hunter-gatherers influence the animals and the plants and all those things that flourish in these ecosystems?
It used to be a common notion that hunter-gatherers lived pretty much in harmony with nature. They didn't change the land the way agriculture eventually would. They just adapted. Then scientists discovered a different picture. For example, they discovered that it was a hungry, roving population of early humans that exterminated the big Ice Age animals, the mammoths and giant sloths and cave bears. Hunter-gatherers also started huge fires that changed the landscape to make it better for hunting. Torben Rick says there's now evidence that early cultures also modified North America's coastlines thousands of years ago. That's where the abalone shells come in. When early Americans on California's islands dumped shells and other refuse, they unknowingly became dune builders.
So there might have been a 5-foot dune there at one time right above the beach, and a group of hunter-gatherers came in, lived on top of that dune, dumped their refuse there, and left. And this creates a pavement that anchors that sand.
Small dunes eventually became big ones, built up like a layer cake, with trash dividing each layer. Then there were intentional changes that people made, like the clam gardens in the Pacific Northwest. People built rock walls into the ocean's shallows.
What these rock walls do, and they're clearly human-made, is they create behind them an area of sandy substrate that's really good for clams. You can kind of think of them like a terrace garden.
Rick has also found layers of sea otter bones, thousands of years old, in California's Channel Islands. The layers above just had sea urchin remains. He thinks people killed the otters because they ate too many shellfish. Since otters also prey on sea urchins, the urchin population then exploded. All those urchins ate up the underwater kelp forests, creating what Rick calls an urchin barren. Rick says, intentionally or not, hunter-gatherers altered the environment for a long, long time, long before agriculture emerged. University of Nebraska anthropologist Raymond Hames, who studies how people interact with their environment, says they had no choice.
The take-home point to some extent is that humans do things to make their life easier. It was really hard to make a living back then. So, you know, you took advantage of the knowledge and skills you had in order to make the environment useful to you.
Hames says sometimes in early human history, changing the environment led to disaster.
The problem is that your successes lead to population growth, which then leads to more pressure on the system to produce more resources. Your successes can set you up for even greater failures.
Many archaeologists argue that societies like the Easter Islanders and the Mayans suffered after overexploiting their forests and land. Torben Rick notes that human activity is threatening places like the Everglades and the Chesapeake Bay now. Scientists are trying to restore them, but to what condition? He says archaeology can provide snapshots of what these places looked like at different moments in time and how much people had altered them.
Well, here's a picture of 500 years ago. Here's a picture of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And you can put those together and come up with a much more concrete picture of how that ecosystem looks, how it changes, how dynamic it is, and where we can expect it to go.
Rick's research on coastal exploitation appears in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Scientists are surprised to discover that a gas, produced mainly in agriculture, is actually doing more to damage the Earth's ozone layer than synthetic chemicals. The culprit is a gas called nitrous oxide, known in your dentist's office as laughing gas. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The Earth is protected from harsh ultraviolet sunlight by a layer of ozone up in the stratosphere. That layer was being depleted by synthetic chemicals used in aerosol spray cans, refrigerators, and air conditioners. We averted global disaster by phasing out those chemicals with a treaty called the Montreal Protocol. But the Montreal Protocol is silent about another chemical that can destroy ozone. That's nitrous oxide. It's always been a normal part of our atmosphere.
But since industrialization, its concentration has been going up.
A.R. Ravishankara is a scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado. He wondered, now that the nasty synthetic chemicals are waning in the atmosphere, how big a deal is nitrous oxide, which comes mainly from agriculture? As he reports in Science magazine, it turns out that it's a big deal.
In fact, there's so much being emitted that right now, nitrous oxide emissions would be the largest ozone-depleting gas emissions today. And it will continue to be in the future.
Nitrous oxide doesn't threaten to devastate the Earth's ozone layer the way the synthetic chemicals did, but it's still eroding a bit of our planetary sunshield, so it's increasing the risk of skin cancer, among other concerns. Now, you may recall that the biggest ozone problem is over Antarctica, an annual thinning event called the ozone hole. That hole is slowly on the mend, and Ravishankara says he expects that healing to continue over the coming decades.
It turns out that nitrous oxide does not have a deleterious effect on the ozone hole. Its effect is on the global ozone layer.
That's because the ozone hole is influenced by super cold clouds found only over the poles. Those clouds release damaging chlorine, but they actually neutralize nitrous oxide. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it isn't easy to reduce human production of nitrous oxide. Cindy Nevison at the University of Colorado says controlling chlorofluorocarbons and other synthetic chemicals that destroy ozone was relatively easy, since just a few factories produced them.
Whereas nitrous oxide is produced by microbes in the soil, and the humans have greatly increased the rate of nitrogen available to these microbes.
When we spread nitrogen fertilizer on the soil, we also feed those bacteria, and they produce more nitrous oxide. Bacteria in seawater also produce nitrous oxide when the fertilizer runs down the rivers and out to sea. Nevison says factories and automobile tailpipes produce some, but not all that much, nitrous oxide.
I think that limiting nitrous oxide is going to be more difficult than, for example, limiting carbon dioxide emissions, and we know how difficult that is.
That's because we need nitrogen. It's an essential part of protein. Carbon dioxide comes mostly from smokestacks and tailpipes.
You can get your energy from other sources than carbon, but you really can't get your food from sources other than nitrogen.
We can't phase out nitrogen fertilizer, she says, and studies show we could make only a modest difference if we use them more carefully. And it's not just the ozone layer that's at issue here. Nitrous oxide also contributes to global warming. So there are more reasons to pay attention to this often neglected gas. Richard Harris, NPR News.
If you were to pick up a pound of coffee at the store, you could reasonably expect it to weigh as much as it did last week or last year or 10 years ago. So you may be surprised to hear that it might not be the case. That's because the pound is defined against the metric system's unit of weight, the kilogram. And the kilogram may be changing. Jeff Brumfield reports.
This story starts with a metal cylinder about the size of a salt shaker. It was forged over 100 years ago in London. From there, it traveled to a suburb of Paris where it was weighed, polished, and locked in a vault. And it's stayed there ever since. This little cylinder is the kilogram. I'll say it again, the kilogram. This is the one on which all other kilograms are based. That makes it very valuable.
I mean, I've picked up its container and I've looked at it, but I have not had the pleasure of actually handling it.
Richard Davis works at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, where the kilogram is kept. He's been in charge of the cylinder since 1993, but they won't actually let him weigh anything with it. And there's a good reason for that.
It can be affected by many things. It can get dirty. It needs to be cleaned. You need to watch out about scratching.
The scientists who keep watch are so paranoid that they've only taken it out three times, in 1889, 1946, and 1989. Each time, they used it to check a set of copies. In the beginning, the copies in the kilogram weighed the same. Today, that's no longer the case. Peter Morris with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He studied the measurements.
They don't have a lot of data, but it shows that they're drifting apart.
In other words, the weight of the official kilogram seems to be changing. No one really knows why. The cylinder might be absorbing air and getting heavier, or washing it before each use may have made it lighter. Or it could be that the copies are changing. There's just no way to tell.
It is the kilogram. There's nothing to compare it to. It is the standard. And so if it's changing, there's no way to know it.
The bottom line is that nobody is sure whether that cylinder in Paris, the official kilogram, weighs the same as it did 100 years ago. The entire metric system hangs in the balance. Well, sort of. The change is small, at most 50 micrograms. That's billionths of a kilogram.
The actual ramifications for a person going to the store and buying something will be negligible. But for very precise work, it makes a difference. And for scientific work, it makes a difference.
And because of this, scientists want to throw out the metal cylinder altogether and replace it with a reliable number that won't change. To get this number, they've got to weigh the kilogram in a completely different way. They've got to measure its mass without using another weight as a reference. And they've got to do it really carefully. So NIST has built a special scale. It's kept out back near the woods in a small building whose entryway is covered in little shreds of something black.
I have to apologize about the rubber on the floor. We have a raccoon that gets up into the rafters there, and he pushes the stuff out the little cracks.
Rich Steiner is in charge of the scale, which is called a watt balance.
You mentioned about being far out. Yes, we're very far out. That we have probably more raccoons come out here than visitors.
Inside of a raccoon-free room is a two-story contraption. Instead of using weights, it uses electrical and magnetic forces to measure the mass of a metal cylinder, an official copy of the kilogram in Paris.
The fundamental part of this is actually fairly simple. It's basically a very highly calibrated bathroom scale.
Now here's how this thing is going to replace the cylinder with a fixed number. Once Rich Steiner can weigh the kilogram accurately enough, he'll be able to relate it to one of the so-called constants of nature, numbers that never change, like the speed of light. This will turn the kilogram into a number as permanent as the constants themselves. The challenge is that the cylinder must be weighed with atomic precision, and that's where the watt balance comes in. It's sensitive to as little as 10 billionths of a kilogram.
If you pulled a hair out of a person's head and then weighed them, we could tell the difference.
Unfortunately, a scale that sensitive is sensitive to a lot of other things, too. Vibrations from passing lawnmowers, for example, the tides, even earthquakes on the other side of the planet upset it, which is why it's taking so long to weigh the kilogram. Steiner's been at it for 16 years, and he considers himself a newcomer to the field.
It's just complicated, because we're making mechanical measurements, and we're doing it at a precision of 8 digits.
Despite all the problems, Steiner is confident that scientists will be able to redefine the kilogram in 5 or 6 more years. When that happens, the little cylinder in Paris will be replaced by a single number 8 digits long. Anybody with a watt balance and a lot of patience will be able to check it for themselves. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.